Today is Wednesday. It is October 27th, 2021, and it's 1:36 in the afternoon. Hi, it's John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals. You can listen to me also on WGN Radio, weekdays from 9 to noon.
I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah, and I am Eric Zorn, the prickly publisher and editor of the Picayune Sentinel, the weekly newsletter that you can get for free if you just write to me at ericzorn@gmail.com.
How many people have now? How many folks you got on your list?
I'm getting close to 20,000 views a week.
Wow.
Which is good. I'm hoping that it keeps growing. So.
And all of them have sent me an email saying the Mincing Rascals should do more live stage podcast recordings.
Yeah, I asked them to last week. I said, if you're interested in seeing us do more live appearances, please email John. And then they filled your email inbox with flattery, I hope.
Actually, it wasn't as flattering as I thought it would be. It's just said, hey, do another show. The only thing that worries me is finding a venue, and then will anybody show up? That's remains my insecurity.
Well, families will.
Mine won't.
We are friends.
Well, we're going to do a test run this Saturday out in Downers Grove. It's already sold out, right, John? So
yeah,
we'll see how that goes.
Although that may have something to do with Thomas Jefferson being there, but... The Chicago Blackhawks took the resignation of now former general manager Stan Bowman this week. He was one of several executives who knew about allegations of sexual misconduct by the team's video coach back in 2010. Bowman and company did nothing about it, and that coach was allowed to leave the team and 3 years later pled guilty to another charge of misdemeanor criminal sexual conduct with another person. For the last decade, the Blackhawks have been the standard of buttoned-up professionalism in Chicago. Their teams won 3 Stanley Cups. Their games sold out. John McDonough and company ran a tight ship. How smart people of good character can lose their moral compass like this is the question Chicagoans are asking today. And I suggest that part of the answer comes from the pressure of having to win. We so love that team. They were so close to starting what would become a dynasty, and they could feel it. And then there on the eve of the Stanley Cup Finals, they get this notice, and then they do nothing about it. Imagine if you went back to that moment in time when all of this is happening, and then the Blackhawks say, hey, wait a minute, we got to fire the coach, and we're going to immediately begin an investigation and interviews with all of the principals in the sexual misconduct case. I wonder what the fans and the columnists and sports radio would have said. And it's conceivable that they would have said, geez, not now. Wait until after the Stanley Cup, for God's sakes. We're about to do something historic here. And I'm not even sure that we're past that point in America or Chicago today. There are instances in Major League Baseball and the NFL of teams cheating because there's such extraordinary pressure to win the Stanley Cup, win the Super Bowl, win the World Series. The Olympics continue to be clouded by cover-up and miscalculations by people as people were being abused. Heck, the Congress is right now about to look into the NFL for conduct that would not be tolerated anywhere else. All the principals that were involved in that meeting in 2010 are gone now. I don't know what else the Blackhawks can do.
I think you're exactly right, John. I think it was sort of this pressure to win, and what should have been done, that the complaint should have been sent to HR immediately.
Yeah.
Immediately for investigation and removing this video coach, Brad Aldridge. And now we know that this kid, this young player, was getting grief from some of the other players after the fact, you know.
Or another coach, yeah.
Making jokes about what happened to him. So it must have gotten out. This coach who's been accused of sexual assault, he denies it. He says it was consensual. The player, John Doe, we don't know who it is. He's not been named, says it was not. It reflects this still standing, you know, winning is everything in professional sports. I think that some of this stuff too probably has some, there's some discomfort around the idea that, and I'm not sure, I'm not putting this on any player or any coach here. I think there has been a longstanding disbelief that men can be the victims of a sex assault.
Especially a professional athlete. I mean, right. Somebody who could defend himself.
The allegation was that the coach pressured him, not physically, didn't like restrain him physically, but it put a lot of pressure on him, saying that he could get him kicked off the team. And that was my understanding of the description of that assault, right? That it wasn't.
There was some sort of the John Doe saying, hey, you know, knock it off. And this guy threatening him, as you said, hey, I have a lot of, I can tell the coaches who to put on the roster and who to get rid of.
Either way, the thing about this that just baffles me is why these executives thought that it would be so hard on the team, why it would hurt their Stanley Cup chances, why it would make them play hockey less well for this to have been going on, for an investigation to have been launched, for this coach to have been separated from the team, for the team to have done the right thing. I don't understand why that's going to impact their performance on the ice. Why do they think that? That doesn't make any sense to me. You're out on the, when you're out playing sports, you're not thinking like, gee, there's turmoil in the suites. No, it's just wrong. And they, who knows why they try to keep it quiet. But even if you were to be the most cynical person in the world, you might say, let's get this out now while every story about the Blackhawks is about the Stanley Cup run, and this will be an, oh yeah, by the way, and also it's not going to dominate the headlines because the town was going crazy for the Hawks then, and looking at the teams they were playing and their chances of winning the Cup. So it would have been something that would have been part of the story at the time, but it would not have, if they had done the right thing, then we wouldn't have had any of this story today. Some of these people might still have their jobs, probably would, and this other victim in another town where they let him go to another place and he victimized yet another hockey player. I guess this was a youth hockey player at this point. That guy would have been spared this man's predations. It's just a colossal screw up on the part of all these people in the Blackhawks. And when we talked about this issue when it first surfaced, I don't know when it was, when X months ago on the Mincing Rascals, we were talking about this. And we were sort of saying, well, if this is what it seems to be, then this is a horrible thing. And I think that we can say that, yes, it was, as it seemed to be, maybe even worse. But John, your point is also quite good. It says, okay, now what? They've gotten rid of everybody who was responsible for this, and they've paid, was the $2 million fine? Mm-hmm. What else can we do? What else should they do? What should we be talking about or thinking about going forward?
I think that there are some questions about some of the folks who have gone on to other jobs in the NHL or other positions of power.
Well, the coach.
Questions
coach.
Around Quenneville.
Yeah.
And how
should he lose his job?
I also think that the team needs to start to reflect and I'll probably own up a little bit more here. It's important to point out that after the team, some days after the championship, that this allegation was taken to HR. This coach was presented with the option of either being the subject of an investigation or resigning.
Yeah,
he resigns. But still, this person is, his name is added to, the rosters of the winning, team. He is brought in for the celebratory.
Has his day with the Stanley Cup.
Yes,
and that moment that you're describing, Lisa, that may be the biggest mistake of all. I mean, that they said you have the option to resign or we'll fire you. And then he resigns and then they wash their hands of it as though it never happened and it's not our problem and it won't ever happen again. How very Catholic Church of them.
Well, yes,
I mean,
that's
crazy.
I was just going to say, John, this is what the Catholic Church did. It's what schools did or used to do anyway with teachers who are accused of being predatory against students. They would say, shame on you. We'd like you to resign. The person would resign. There would be no mark on his record or her record, I suppose. And that teacher would go to another school and the same thing would happen again. And that was inevitable, it seems to me, with this particular coach and the Blackhawks allowing him to resign and not making sure that he didn't get in a situation where he could do that again. That's where this sin compounds itself.
It's not just so that the mark is so that, you can walk away without a mark. Nobody cares about this coach or a coach or the priest. The institution wants to keep its reputation. That's why those options are there. And mm-hmm. also the structure of a human resources department, which is basically there to
protect the company.
The front end litigator on behalf of the company.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And yes. Nothing more. It's yes. Not about make improving culture. It's about protecting the institution.
But I think that's the answer to Eric's question too, Lisa, and that is, I mean, how hard would it be? But the Blackhawks had a pretty polished up reputation at the time. Remember, they were the laggards trying to get into the 20th century. They weren't on TV for the longest time. And, you know, the United Center wasn't all that cleaned up. But then eventually the Sun took charge and the team started to win. And then they had these star players. And then John McDonough comes over from the Cubs. If you ever saw the management team at the Blackhawks, I don't know what you would expect to see from an NHL franchise or a pro sports team's management, but everybody wore dark suits with white shirts and dark ties, and they didn't smile a lot. They were on task. And I think McDonough and that management culture was such that they could not manage a blemish like this at that point in time.
I don't want to divert here, but we're talking about white male management culture here, and this is a prime case of calling for diversity in the ranks. It's fine that they all look buttoned up in their dark suits.
Oh, I'm not saying that's a virtue. No, you're making my point, Lisa. I think that was part of the problem. I mean, maybe that's not entirely my point, but I think it's consistent with what I'm saying, that it was such a tight circle of like-minded and dressed people that any infraction would be like, oh my God, we have to cast that out from the circle. We can't have that on the Blackhawks circle. And so off it goes. I'm thinking about Eric's question about how hard would it be. And I think if you looked at that team back then, you can see that would have not been easy for them to deal with.
I guess so.
That sounds like I'm rationalizing it. I'm not. I'm trying to answer the question Eric and I have of how does this happen?
Yeah, I get it. Sort of like, this is how things are done. We're just going to sort of put our heads down.
Yeah.
We're almost there, kids.
Yep.
Let's just get it across the
yep.
finish line. But I don't think that they needed to wait. Why would a headline look bad going into the Stanley Cup, something like this? I'm not sure that this would get out publicly. This person has sued as a John Doe and has you know, the right to sort of keep that under wraps. Maybe the team would announce something, but they could have sent that to HR right away and pulled this guy out of circulation without anybody knowing what the situation was. If this person said, listen, I'm dealing with this, I don't need my teammates to know, I think that probably could have been something that they navigated.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point, Lisa, which is that they could have actually had it both ways. They could have had an untrammeled run to the Stanley Cup without the public being involved in this, but they could have immediately distanced themselves from this guy, isolated him, made sure they dealt with it after the season was over, but made sure that he had no contact with anyone else, and that they separated themselves immediately from him after the season, if not during the playoff run. Who's going to notice that the video coach is not there anymore? No one's going
right.
to notice that.
And this sort of the domino effect of them not taking this action and waiting, and hey, you know, you still can have your Stanley Cup, is that it diminishes the, I guess, alleged victim's claims here. It diminishes it to the point where, okay, it gets out, and now the players are sort of saying, oh, do you miss your boyfriend? You know, and sort of making a joke that, like, it's consensual in some way when it's clear that this person, you know, was traumatized.
Some people are saying that, you know, the Patrick Kanes and Jonathan Taves of the world should be speaking up and out more right now. I don't know if they're getting good counsel or bad counsel there, but as Lisa says, this is 2021, man. Man up, you know, have a conscience.
I think in 2010 they should have done
that. Well, that too.
I know they were kids then, but I do think that they need to say something. You've got a big job. You're in the public eye.
Well, they should, you know, as high as the Blackhawks were starting in 2010 and for that decade, they sure are low now. They've set a record for futility on the ice, going as long as they have without ever leading in a game. They haven't won a game yet this season. Their consecutive sold-out streak has ended. The general manager is gone.
They're thanking God for the Bears, right? Bears suck so bad.
Really? 18-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse goes on trial next week. He's charged with several crimes, including murder. This all stems from the riots that took place in Kenosha in 2020 in the summer over the shooting of Jacob Blake. The judge in the case has ruled that Rittenhouse's lawyers can call the people Kyle shot looters and rioters, but the prosecution cannot describe them as victims or even alleged victims. The judge will also not allow video and still images of Rittenhouse posing with white nationalists or of him punching a girl near his school a few years back. You have these ugly images of Kyle Rittenhouse, and the judge is not going to allow that. Looks like the judge is going to make it difficult for the prosecution to make their case.
One small correction, and it may sound minor, is that the judge ruled that the defense attorneys may refer to the people who Rittenhouse shot as rioters and looters and so on. It's not that they just can, and they can only perhaps do that during closing statements, closing arguments, not during the course of the trial.
I was aware of that. I guess that distinction matters.
I think that it does matter because during the closing arguments, that's when the defense counsel can call Rittenhouse a murderer, and a lot of bets are off during the closing arguments, as you know, in trials. The idea that they can't refer to these people who he shot and killed or wounded as victims, it makes perfect sense because the question at issue at this trial is whether a crime was committed. And legally speaking, a victim is a victim of a crime. So if you were to call Joseph Rosenbaum a victim, then you're basically assuming the conclusion that he is the victim of a crime, and that in the Rittenhouse's defense, self-defense claim is invalid. So that language matters. So that's what the judge is saying. He says you can't call them victims because that presumes the conclusion of this trial. They will be victims if Kyle Rittenhouse is guilty of a crime.
Well, then what about the other side? What about, I mean, isn't rioting a crime? And if you describe them as rioters, then doesn't that presume?
Yes, that will go toward Rittenhouse's state of mind. And if they can show that he knew that these people who he was dealing with had a propensity toward violent acts, that might increase his fear of them when he was being, say, chased by Rosenbaum or being chased down the street by these people. It's going to be a fine legal line to thread, but this is all about, essentially, it's all about Kyle Rittenhouse's state of mind when he was acting in those few minutes there. Was he in legitimate fear of death or great bodily harm from Rosenbaum? That's the issue here. It's not whether he's a bad guy, whether he's, you know, he's a punk and a vigilante and a would-be cop and a right-wing nut who associates with white supremacists, all that stuff. We can stipulate to all of that. That's all true, to my mind. But the question is, Does he then forfeit his right to self-defense? That's what the jury is going to be looking at. That's what the judge is looking at. That's what the defense is going to try to establish, and the prosecution is going to try to undermine.
For that reason, Eric, do you think that the judge was right in not allowing the video and the images I was describing?
Unless you want to bring in, say, the character and the criminal record of the people who he shot, which I don't think you should do either.
He wasn't aware of that. He wasn't aware of their past.
Well, but neither were they aware of him having hit a girl in a parking lot at some point, right? When he appeared with the Proud Boys, that was after his arrest. So you don't want to turn this into a character contest. You want to find out what was happening that night during that fraught and terrible moment when this was all going on. And that's when you're going to decide and discover whether Rittenhouse was acting in self-defense or whether he was not acting in self-defense, whether his shooting was reasonable or not. And that's, that is the only question.
I think in one of the cases it absolutely will be judged reasonable. But what would you both have said about then allowing that video or that imagery?
Because it is a self-defense case, the lines are sort of narrower here. And I think that's what the judge is telling everybody that, hey, we are going to restrict this to sort of in the moment activity, in the moment, what's unfolding right there on the streets. We're not going to sort of look beyond. I think one of the issues that will also be raised that they're going to really have to thread the needle on is that he says that he was acting in self-defense when he shot and killed two people and injured a third. So, and one of the people who was shot to death, the defense is expected to argue that that person posed a danger that night because he was threatening to kill people and engage in arson. And so one of the battles we'll probably see play out is that none of that occurred in the moments preceding Rittenhouse opening fire. The Tribune has reported that. Other outlets have reported that. So they're really, in these pretrial hearings, they're really threading the needle on this.
The thing is, like, with Rosenbaum, who's the first guy, the guy who chased him across the parking lot, and they ended up in a corner where we didn't see exactly what happened, but apparently Rosenbaum, this older, larger fellow, had cornered him, was grabbing at his gun. And the question is, if Kyle Rittenhouse had had interactions with him before, if he had seen, because I've seen video of Rosenbaum from that night, and he is very belligerent. But I don't know if Rittenhouse saw that, if the kid saw that, if the kid knew that, or if it was just this momentary interaction with him. But if earlier in the evening Rosenbaum had threatened or yelled at or looked threatening to Rittenhouse, that could affect his state of mind. I think that's what the legal argument is going to be about here. But basically, the more stuff I read about this, the more commentary I read about it, the more it's clear that people have just gone to their camps.
Oh, yeah.
That the left has gone into this. He's a Trumper, and he's a gun carrier, and he was out there guarding property against Black Lives Matter protesters. He's a bad guy. We want him to be convicted. And you've got people on the right who are Second Amendment champions who are saying that this is exactly the kind of person we need out there shooting bad guys who attack them and so on. That everyone has fallen right into their political camps. And this trial should not be about politics. It should not be about Kyle Rittenhouse's politics. It shouldn't be about the politics of the protesters who were there. It should be about the interactions that they had and what Kyle Rittenhouse believed at the time and whether that was a reasonable belief.
What, he was 17. He was living in suburban Antioch. He wasn't even old enough to be carrying this AR-15 style rifle that he was carrying. If you take somebody's life, I think that there should be some kind of penalty to pay. That's putting it lightly, not judging him at all. But I do think that, oh my God, you know, two lives were taken, another injured.
But just that principle right there, that if you take somebody's life, you have to pay a price. If you are acting in legitimate self-defense, if you change some of the variables here, and let's say that this is a woman out for a walk at night and she's got a gun that's unregistered gun in her purse and she's cornered by a knife-wielding maniac and she shoots and kills him, mm-hmm. do we penalize her because her gun wasn't licensed?
Yeah, she wasn't allowed to carry. But Rittenhouse wasn't that. He wasn't that.
I mean,
he's going to be found guilty of the weapons charge. I'm certain of that.
Yeah.
But he didn't relinquish his right to self-defense because he was a few months
shy. I know that, Eric. And that's why I'd be a terrible juror on this, because that other stuff you said about him that's not relevant maybe in this case bothers me so much. Like, what the hell were you even doing there? In your scenario, the woman that's walking across the road and she's got an unregistered gun in her purse, she's not harming anybody. She's not sticking her neck into harm's way. Rittenhouse went looking for trouble. He went looking for trouble, and he found it. And so whatever the hell happens to Rittenhouse now, I know this is why I would be a bad juror. I want him to go to jail. I want him to go to jail for you know what? And they'll say, why did you send him in jail? And I go, because he's Kyle Rittenhouse. Good night, everybody. There's my answer. We'll talk more about this down the road. The Chicago Tribune's editorial today, Eric, is not on Team Trump. It's not on Team Zorn. Wait, there's a difference.
They've never been on Team Trump. Reference to my friends on the editorial board.
Well, they weren't on Team Clinton, which was
Team Gary Johnson. Okay? the paper is trying to forget about it.
The headline in their editorial today is Remaps Should Empower Citizens. They're empowering the powerful instead. Did you see that op-ed or the editorial of your former colleagues there?
Of course I did. I'm a diligent reader of the Chicago Tribune.
What did you make of them?
I think that they're naive. I think that if you look at what's going on right now in Virginia, where the good government Democrats agreed to have a commission, and a nonpartisan commission, to try to reapportion the congressional districts there, that the it's going to go to the Supreme Court because they can't agree. When you have these bipartisan commissions, they can never agree, and it always gets thrown to some other body. This is going to the Virginia Supreme Court, and they're probably going to carve up Virginia in a way that's going to cost the Democrats a few of the seats that they would have had if they'd carved up the map themselves. And that actually could stand to change the balance of power in the U.S. Congress, because the Democrats decided they'd play nice in Virginia. And I don't want the Democrats to play nice in Illinois. I want the Democrats to take advantage, as long as the rules permit it. And you've got states like Wisconsin, North Carolina, Texas, that the Republicans are gerrymandering to a fairly well. The Democrats, if they're going to have any hope of ever, say, passing a national law that requires every state to get rid of the way they gerrymander, to do have some federal standards, then you're going to have it that way. You're going to have to let the state, you're going to have to gerrymander when you can, because otherwise you're just being a patsy.
You know, I hate to say you're being persuasive there. I mean, I get your point. You're being very pragmatic. But if there was a national rule and everybody followed it, I think my friend Thomas Jefferson is going to say this. He was a fan of the idea of dropping a rectilinear grid over the nation, and that would, by happenstance, be your district. That would be who you represented. Mm-hmm. And in the long run, it would sort of work itself out. At least I think that's what he said about that. I'm going to bring this up with Jefferson when we're on stage on Saturday.
I'll look forward to what he says. The reason that I would object to that or have problems with that is that because of the way the population is distributed, you're going to have the Democrats. If you drop a grid over the country, Democrats are concentrated in big cities, and you're probably going to dilute Democratic vote doing that, and you're almost certainly going to dilute minority votes. And why some of these districts have to be drawn in such a funny way is because we are trying to preserve voting rights for minorities and carve out some minority districts. Otherwise, if you just laid a grid down, you might have a situation where just about all the legislators were white, and then you'd have a couple of black and maybe Hispanic districts that are packed together somewhere. But it's an appealing idea, but it doesn't work with the Voting Rights Act.
I don't know if I think that the flaws with the Senate or the idea of the Senate that they came up with or the power that they gave the Senate. When you look at the color-coded map, the United States of America, geographically is very red, but these blue dots run the roost. Well, that's because those blue dots are people, and people should matter, not wide open spaces of Wyoming. So it looks like a red country, but it's really it's a blue country. Yet the Senate has so much power. You give an inordinate amount of power to Wyoming and North Dakota compared to, say, in Illinois. We got a lot more people than they do, than a lot of those states do combined.
Yeah. It's something like 40. California has 40 times the number of people of Wyoming and the same number of senators. And you're right. Land doesn't vote. Land should not have a say in what goes on in the United States Senate. But that was the compromise that they hammered out 250 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's the compromise that we're stuck with. And I do mean stuck with it. I think that that the way the Senate works, especially given how sclerotic the Senate can be, how it requires a supermajority in the Senate to get anything done, means that you have to have a phenomenal percentage of the American to enact any sort of democratic or progressive initiatives. You've got to have a phenomenal percentage of voters behind that in order to get that done, because of the way the country skews red if you just give votes to the states like that. The Senate is a profoundly democratic, anti-democratic institution.
Gerrymandering is a result of trying to make these districts a little more even, to give African Americans, Latinos, others who have been traditionally disenfranchised in the political processes, more representation. And so how, if we do put these grids over, and I know you've jumped to the Senate, I'm not sure how to iron that out. I just know, I'm just looking at the lower chamber and thinking there's got to be a way to sort of iron this out without disenfranchising our fellow countrymen who mm-hmm. have been traditionally disenfranchised. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you do that.
By the way, speaking of gerrymandering, Darren LaHood is going to have to run against Adam Kinzinger for the Congress, if Kinzinger decides to run. Or would you put it the other way around? Adam Kinzinger is going to have to run against Darren LaHood. LaHood's from Peoria's 18th. He's a Trump supporter. Kinzinger, who has been critical of the former president, is in the 16th. And they will both now be in the same newly drawn district.
And if DraftKings is taking bets on this, I will put my money on LaHood over Kinzinger. because of the way the Republican base is behind Donald Trump.
Yeah. So that, do you think that's, I saw this as a battle royale for the state's Republican Party, for the heart and the soul of the state's Republican Party. Are you going to go with the Trump guy, or are you going to go with the only guy that had the courage to be a Republican? He's nobody's Democrat, this Adam Kinzinger, but he's not a Trumper. So this is an opportunity to finally punch that ticket, world, and you say they're going to go with Team Trump on this.
I think they will, although it's possible that this will be a wider open primary than just the two of them. And you might have some other candidates in there, all of whom will be Trumpers. And Kinzinger could, say, get 30, 35% of the vote and win a primary, in which case it would be a pretty interesting. Given the way the district's drawn, he would be a presumptive winner.
Yeah, right.
A token Democrat. I would doubt that. I think this is actually a spur for Kinzinger to think about running in a statewide race, that he might see the lay of the land and go statewide. But either way, he's going to run up against Trumpers. So.
Depending on how that's drawn and the specific contours, I mean, he's won election, I don't know, 3-4 times. And with the backing of, I think, some moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans in the primary, maybe some more moderate Republicans. We didn't know who were out there. And so depending on the contours of this, I think it could be a contest if it's the two of them, because in many ways, I think that the two sort of see the world similarly. They're both conservatives in their own way. Just because Kinzinger is anti-Trump does not mean that he is not a dyed-in-the-wool sort of old school conservative Republican. And if he can get that message out there, that he, which I don't know that he can.
Yeah.
Yes, Darren LaHood is an arch conservative. Yes, he has stood with Trump, but standing with Trump and cheering him on are two different things. Standing with him is also a political move. We were talking before we went on air about how he served on Trump's re-election committee, yet I didn't hear him sort of taking the bullhorn out and saying, hey, we got to re-elect this guy or the country's going to sink and let's try to take over the Capitol. And when it came time in January, after the January 6th riot at the Capitol, when he was asked about why he didn't vote to impeach Trump, then he said, look, we're going to have a new guy in office in X number of days anyway. Not exactly a ringing endorsement for Trump or to say, hey, you know, he did nothing wrong. No, that's not what he said.
Boy, you see that glass is half full. I see that answer is half empty. They were impeaching him a second time for a reason, and that was so he couldn't run again, make him pay a price for what he did, for what happened. That he says, well, don't worry, he's going to be out of office, so problem solved, I think misses the point of the second impeachment. Come on.
It's not exactly criticizing him or supporting him. That's all I'm saying.
No, that is absolutely supporting him.
I just don't think that when you're matching Kinzinger up with anybody else in the Republican Party who is anywhere close to a Trumper, that the party right now seems to be in Trump's thrall still. I mean, the polls, when you poll Republicans, they are behind this guy. They are behind the big lie. This is what is so incredibly troubling about where our politics are right now, which is that we're not arguing about little things in policy. We're not arguing about tax rates and things. We're arguing about whether democracy itself was thwarted and undermined by the deep state a year ago, an absurd argument. But that's what's animating this party.
He is running the party because he's traveling the country, still having these rallies and at least acting like he's going to run again in 2024.
Oh, he's going to run
again. Still keeping things active. I have transitioned from getting sort of the White House press releases to getting Trump press releases for his organization. I probably get 10, 15 of them a day. And most of them are about fundraising. And it's really aggressive. So I've got to believe that he's running for something, or he's going to put a lot of money behind candidates that will make the difference in midterms and maybe put the Republicans in control of one or both chambers.
Well, there are billboards in Chicago. There are billboards up in town off the Kennedy saying Trump won. Have you seen those? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Yeah. My producer's seen them, and a lot of people were telling me about them. I haven't seen them myself, but it says Trump won 120 million votes. I don't even know what 120 million is supposed to represent. Some say it looks like he won by 120 million votes. There were 140 plus million votes cast, so I don't know what that number is supposed to represent, but somebody's spending real money on billboards throughout Chicagoland. If we went back to Kinzinger versus LaHood for a minute, if Kinzinger were smart, he would take a page from Mike Madigan's book, and that is he would get other candidates to run, like you said, Eric, who are super Trumpers, just put up some dummy candidates who would say red meat stuff, and then people would vote for that, and they would thin the LaHood vote, and then Kinzinger would sail in. I mean, that's the way that game gets played in Chicago, right?
Yeah, it is the way the game gets played, and I don't think he's going to have to recruit those people. I think there are going to be a number of really hardcore. I mean, look what's going on right now in the governor's race. I think that Kinzinger might have a chance in a Republican primary that's split among these candidates who are afraid to distance themselves from Trump. I mean, you've got the main candidates who are running for governor in the Republican primary. I think there are four or five of them now. I'm not sure how many exactly we are officially in, but none of them are willing to say that Donald Trump lost the election a year ago. Think about that. Think about how crazy those people truly are. And that's where we are right now. So if you have a sane Republican, and Illinois has always cottoned to sane Republicans, and I would call Jim Edgar a sane Republican.
Yeah,
I would
call Jim Thompson.
I would even call George Ryan. I know, you know, he went to prison and everything like that, but he was a moderate, middle-of-the-road
Bob Michael. Republican. Speaking of that district, Bob Michael was the last true centrist on the right.
So there is a candidate, and I talked to her a few months ago. She is Catalina Loth is her name. More than a few months ago in February, she was already getting to work, and she is a staunch pro-Trump Republican. She was throwing her hat in the ring and starting fundraising back in February to run against Kinzinger. And I don't know that she would back off. She has got the support. I mean, Corey Lewandowski, as soon as she announced, took to Twitter and said, "Hey, you know, this is a strong candidate. She can win and you know, support the America First agenda."
I think she's a very strong candidate. I remember she ran for Congress and almost won a primary, but was considered a pretty formidable candidate at that time. She wasn't a surprise. Do you remember what?
She ran against Lauren Underwood's district in that north and west suburban district. She was up against Oberweis, but he bested her.
Is Oberweis still going to be running? He always runs for stuff, spends his family's fortune. Somewhere the kids are going, "Dad, please stop. We can only make so many milkshakes."
I have no idea. Yeah, but look at the lines at those places. Money.
It's a very good milkshake. It is.
I am really. I'm wondering whatever happened to Erica Harold. She ran for attorney general, I believe, in 2018, and looked like she was going to do all right, and then lost and kind of disappeared. She's a former Miss America, and I believe she's a Harvard Law graduate.
Oh, that's right.
And I thought that she would come back and be a really formidable statewide candidate, but I have not heard much from her since then.
Two other things I just want to bounce off of you guys. Let's just sort of update everybody on the score of the city of Chicago. Lori Lightfoot's administration, the police, the firefighters, and the first responders have also got another suit asking that they don't have to upload their vaccination status to the city's portal. That decision, or at least the next step, is going to come down Friday. I'm still betting that Lori Lightfoot's going to get her way on this, and that most of the police officers are going to upload their status to the portal. In fact, most of them have been, and most of them are getting vaccinated. Angry as you can be about the heavy hand of the mayor, at the end of the day, you do want your job and you do want those benefits. And you're not going to work in Indiana, although one of the senators from Indiana said, "Hey, come on over here, we could use you." Pretty much the same players are asking for the same thing, and the mayor's still not compromising. The lawyer, though, for the firefighter said this to us today: "How about if we don't upload anything to the portal, but two or three times a week we show up at the precinct as we go to work, and we have a piece of paper that shows that we've just passed a COVID test? Wouldn't that accomplish what the mayor wants?" Maybe Lori Lightfoot, if she would just be a little flexible, I know she wants them to upload their status to the portal, but how about if she bends a little because it would accomplish the same thing, right? At the end of the day, we just want to know that these guys are safe to go out on the street.
Who's going to pay for these tests? And these are the rapid tests that are super expensive. Who's going to pay for that?
He didn't bring that up.
That's a great question.
He didn't bring that up.
And if they're willing to pay for a daily test, I think the police officers were offering a daily test. Catanzaro was offering a daily test as a substitute. If they are willing to pay for a daily test, and I don't know what those cost, but they're not free.
They're not. I've
lost my patience with these people who won't get vaccinated. Police officers are dying. Many more are dying from COVID than are dying from gunshots. And for some reason, they are just digging their heels. And some of them are just digging their heels in over this. And it's about public safety. Their job is to protect public safety. And they if they are carrying this virus around because they're too stubborn to get vaccinated, I mean, that's a disgrace. We talk about this every week.
And I know that argument is so last week, Eric. I know that, but you've got to move past that. No, you got to give. So if you're the mayor, that's the problem that Lori Lightfoot has. I'll bet she's just as ticked as you, and it's got her name on it. So I'll bet she's not going to be very flexible. And I'm thinking, maybe the guy's got a point there. At the end of the day, you want a safe police force, and you want cops out there. So fine, give in. But boy, that will look like that. It'll look like the mayor giving in.
Well, I don't understand why there hasn't been a sort of a pivot in this argument. Okay, I have a billboard down the street, not mine. There is a billboard down the street that says police officers wear this, and it's body armor so that they can go to home to this. And it's a picture of an officer clearly surrounded by family. Why is City Hall, why are we not all pitching this as sort of some kind of armor for police officers? It's the same thing. I also do not understand how we've devolved into this weird battle over it. But I can also say this for a firefighter who same deal there too, by the way. Make that same argument to our firefighters too. Mm-hmm. I want them to be protected. But also, I do not want them to respond personally to my home, you know, if there's some kind of medical emergency here, they're not vaccinated, and they expose the person in my household to COVID, and that person has a respiratory issue, a very critical and serious respiratory issue. How the hell did we get here?
Every week we talk about this, just about, and every week I get more worked up about it. Like, come on, get the damn shot. Right.
Well, do you think there's much to be made about the size of the crowd that showed up at that rally? At police headquarters, and a lot of people. It was raining that day. It was a miserable day. In New York, they had a crowd. In Chicago, there was not, you think, by the Catanzaro and this union, it's this gigantic force. There's not a lot of people down for that thing.
No, but I do think that in the court of public opinion, he is hurting the wider force. I do. I think that people see Catanzaro as unhinged. It's not my opinion. It's what I'm hearing. And are using him as a springboard to sort of indict the entire police force. They put him in the job. They elected him.
Yep. Did you see the this week with John Oliver? He said something about, not all cops are bad cops.
John Catanzaro, the head of Chicago's Fraternal Order of Police, told his officers flat out, do not comply. This guy is a lot. He's been suspended 8 times and has received more misconduct complaints per year of service than 96% of his fellow Chicago officers. And yet, this is who his union members chose to represent them. So next time someone says to you, not all cops are bad, you can just respond, no, just their favorite ones.
Here's the quote from John Oliver. He said, police are supposed to be keeping the public safe. That is the point of their jobs, yet some don't seem to give much of a crap about that. If an officer wants to quit over COVID-related mandates, effing let them. Let the individuals who clearly don't care about public safety stop being in charge of public safety. It really is that simple.
That was his mic drop, and he was on fire on that. In sports, after the Bears took an embarrassing shellacking by Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, a new controversy came up. Tom Brady threw his milestone 600th career touchdown pass to Mike Evans in the game. After Evans caught the ball, he gave it to a fan in the stands. Brady wanted the ball back, and after a team official came up and with some persuasion and promises of team merchandise, the fan gives the ball back. It was a $500,000, potentially, gift back to Tom Brady. And the question has become, would you have given the ball back to Tom Brady because he wants a souvenir football, or would you have kept it and sold it and maybe pocketed $500,000? What do you do in that situation?
That's a good question. You know, I have so little patience for the idea that this ball is worth more than an average football. I know sports memorabilia, it makes no sense to me at all. If I'm in the stands and a guy comes up to me and says, hey, we'll give you some season tickets for this, I'd say sure, because it wouldn't occur to me that it's worth $500,000.
Yeah.
It's a touchdown pass, one of 600 that he's thrown. I don't get that. But obviously, if you're thinking it through, then you hang on to the ball because you have no obligation. It's like if the guy had come to you and handed you $500,000, and they said, hey, can we have that back?
That is a nice way to put it.
Yeah, he did get a Bitcoin. I think Brady gave him a Bitcoin as well, worth, what, $62,000 or something like that?
Yeah. Tom Brady said, I'm going to give him a Bitcoin. I presume he'll honor that. The team gave the fan Tom Brady's helmet, two Tom Brady jerseys. They gave him the shoes that Evans wore, the guy that caught the pass. They gave him $1,000 in free merchandise at the team store. They gave him season tickets for the remaining season and season tickets for next season as well. And Brady throws in a Bitcoin. I would have kept the football. I would have run from the stadium with the football like I'm on my way to a touchdown myself. If I knew, you're right, because if this whole argument changes if somehow the guy magically hands him $500,000. I think people then see what the point I'm trying to make is, that he just gave you like four college educations at good schools for your family, and yet Tom Brady wants a souvenir on his shelf, another souvenir on his shelf. My wife said maybe you should turn the argument around. Rather than asking, because some of my colleagues and my high and mighty listeners are like, oh, the right thing to do is to give the ball back. It's not your ball. I'm not sure that it's as a possession Tom Brady's ball either. I mean, he threw it, but whatever. But Brenda said, turn it around and say, okay, what's Tom Brady's obligation in this case? You're Tom Brady. You're worth $1 zillion. You've got all the trophies anybody would ever need. Oh, there's another one that just went into the stands, and that guy could get $500,000 for it. And you're going to ask for it back? Right? Like, would you even ask for it back if you're Tom Brady? Doesn't that seem a little puny?
I feel like there was more going on there than maybe, I don't know, meets the eye. This all became kind of a dust-up, and Fortune magazine reported that he's a part owner in this FTX trading, this Bitcoin company.
Who Tom Brady
is.
It almost makes it
seem like, okay, this is a little bit of some free advertising. I don't know. Is that too cynical?
Well, okay. So, Lisa, thanks for saying yes. We'll look forward to seeing you at the Mincing Rascals live podcast performance. And again, it's going to be a short version, 30 minutes. We did about an hour today. We'll be up on the stage for 30 minutes in advance of Mr. Jefferson's 90. So we'll do about a two-hour show for our listeners there. And I'm glad that the two of you have said, yeah, let's do it. And Erica, keep pushing. If people really want us to do this somewhere at a bar, I don't know, wouldn't a bar that seats about 150 people be about right?
People would trample each other getting in. It would be like the Who concert. I think we're going to need a bigger venue than that.
Yeah, I think we're going to need a boat.
Write to John Williams at WGN and tell him your venue suggestion.
Listen, that would help. John Williams at WGNradio.com. Okay, Eric, Lisa, see you Saturday. Thanks for joining us. We're produced by Ashley Byhun and Elif Garris, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week. All right, campers.
All right.
Did you get the email from Elif just saying what to do and where to be and all that?
Yeah, and I got my costume ready. I'm all good.
I'll be in a suit.
Are you gonna wear a tux?
No, but I will wear a suit. I always, you know, wear a suit.
I'll probably wear a sport coat then, something like that.
Well,
I'll dress nicer than I am now.
It's just whatever's comfortable for you. What we want to show people is the real Lisa Donovan and the real Eric Zorn.
Like a Bulls t-shirt?
Whatever is the real Eric Zorn and the real Lisa Donovan, that's what we want.
John just glided right by that question. Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.